Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to remember a one-of-a-kind World War II hero. He enlisted 4 years before the war, got married 8 months before Pearl Harbor. As you heard him describe in such vivid detail, Robert Thacker flew into Pearl Harbor on the morning of December 7th, 1941, was shot at by American forces who mistook him for a Japanese bomber as he landed his unarmed B-17 at Hickam Field. You heard him describe the decision he made on the ground there that saved his life and the lives of his crew moments before he watched a formation of enemy bombers end the lives of men he had trained and flown with. That was just the first hour of World War II for America. He would serve through the rest of the war, not to mention the Korean War, the Cold War, the Vietnam War, 31 years of Air Force service, retiring as a colonel. Let's hear some of what else he did during World War II, first in the Pacific and then in Europe.
We started out doing 800-mile Y searches every fourth day. Then along in about February, we went on over to Australia and Port Moresby, New Guinea, and I flew 48 missions out of Port Moresby. Got a little few side stories of my tour in against the Japanese, and then I snuffled my way after a year over there where the big guns were, and that was in England, and I flew a tour in England, which is rather unique.
Yeah, to have flown particularly that number of bombing missions both in the Pacific and in Europe. And now, when you get to that high number of a bombing count, a lot of guys would have been back home already. Why were you out there so long? Is it you wanted to be, or because they kept you there?
Well, I guess they kind of decided that after a year of operation that they would send our unit home, and I was sent home, and I did a started training crews, and I decided that training crews was not my deal, and I wanted to get ahead. And in the military, you go where the greatest noise is, and the greatest noise was in Europe, because Germany was the number one guy and the Japanese was the number two. So I sniffled my way and flew a B-17 tour out of England. And it was the smartest decision I ever made.
Why was that?
Because I got myself promoted.
Yeah, that shows up in the pocketbook too. Well, you said there are some side stories about all those missions out of Port Moresby. Entertain us with a couple if you have time. I'm sure you never got shot at or anything.
Well, this is kind of a funny story on me. During the Battle of the Coral Sea, my B-17 had some radar antennas on it. We were just on a reconnaissance mission at about 20,000 feet. All of a sudden, my radar operator picked up a return only. That's the radar in those days was very primitive. And he said, "I've got an object up there about 40 miles out. Let's go take a look at it. This is the Coral Sea battle." So I cruised over there, took about a right turn of 5 degrees, and well, we didn't know what was down there, but all of a sudden I started getting anti-aircraft return. So I said, "Well, if they're shooting at me and I'm an American B-17, that must be one of the Japanese cruisers." So I told the bombardier to open the bombay door and we'll make a run on them. And I'm carrying 4 1,000-pound bombs. Any one of those bombs would have blown a cruiser in half. He set the bomb site up with intervalometer. You drop 1, 2, 3, 4. Damn. He put 2 short and 2 over. So when I got back to Moresby, 7 Mile, I had a reception. I had a brigadier general and a full colonel. He said, "Lieutenant, you just missed the USS Chicago." In those days, the Navy didn't tell you anything. Here I am, the only reconnaissance airplane airborne in the South Pacific, and I didn't know where the USS Chicago was. I didn't know where any of the Navy was. But that sort of piqued up the little deal, and we got a little bit more information on what the Navy was doing. So, you know.
What did that feel like in that moment to be told that news?
Well, I was happy that we certainly didn't hurt anybody. God, if we had hit the Chicago, that would have just been terrible. It would have ruined my career, really. It would have been awful. Of course, friendly fire is very common in the military. Very common.
That's a lot of missions, and I know there's a lot of stories, and maybe some of them run together. But give us a sense of what it was like to take those missions, what you would encounter along the way. What were some of the, besides that one, which is incredible, maybe the moments where you felt your crew might actually be in jeopardy?
Quickly, I'll just run through, say, a mission, B-17 bombers in the European theater working out of England. By that time, I was, in all honesty, I was probably the most experienced combat B-17 pilot in the business, period. And I always flew as a lead crew. You're leading the wing, or you're leading the division, or I even led the United States Air Force complete with 2,600 bombers running on Berlin, and you have authority to turn them around. You have authority to do anything. That's big authority. But you get up about midnight, you take special lead crew training, and you get off at first light, and there's a group of 54 B-17s every 2 minutes departing the UK. And that is a big, big thrill. The best mission I think I ever ran, and with the bombardier that I thought was absolutely superb. We ran on Peenemünde. Peenemünde is the Germans' big rocket development place. And my bombardier absolutely destroyed Peenemünde from 25,000 feet. That was a great ride. Just a tremendous, tremendous feeling to be part of that game, part of the profession that you've chosen for your life's work. And I've got some pictures of how my bombardier did that day.
Oh, I'd love to see those. And I'd also like to hear, I mean, I didn't hear you mention anywhere in there anything about flak, anything about enemy fighters, but I'm sure that's not because it didn't happen.
Oh, we had lots of flak and lots of enemy fighters, and you know who they were looking for, don't you? Well, what the German fighters were really looking for were people that lost an engine and thing like that and could not stay in formation. The German pilots were no better or no worse than the American fighter. They always, everybody wants to survive in this business. Survival is very, very necessary. Actually, we defeated everybody by the people at home that produced this massive wealth of offensive material. We're no better fighters than the Germans or the Japanese. We just out-manufactured them, that's all. How can the Japanese, with 70 million people, defeat a country in those years with 130 million people? Who's going to win the war? The guy with 130 million people.
Well, and you speak to the manufacturing, and I would think you have a good perspective on that, because you were in the Air Corps from 1937, when there were very few planes, very few resources, and then you saw it at its height at the end of the war. Can you put that into perspective for us, how great the contrast was from pre-war forces for America to at the end of World War II?
Well, I don't have much of a background, of course, for those kind of questions, but...
You saw it, right? You certainly saw the difference.
I was amazed at the motion pictures that we've been able to maintain by the Navy, of the masses of seagoing vessels, merchant marines, many of the days. On my first tour in the Japanese Empire, I was the only airplane offensive for that day in the whole theater because we had no aircraft. You're in Port Moresby, New Guinea, and there's nothing in Port Moresby, New Guinea that looks like a B-17. You have got to manufacture that in Seattle and get it over there with a knowledgeable crew, which is a tremendous, tremendous task. But we did it, and of course we won eventually. But for the first year of operation in the Pacific, the Aussies really thought they were going to be invaded. Well, they were invaded in Darwin, which is northern Australia. They weren't landed, but they certainly wiped out Darwin.
Well, and you talked about everybody's goal was to survive. And you already indicated how close you came on December 7th to not surviving. But with all those missions you flew in the B-17s, I'm sure there are a few others where you came pretty close to not making it home. Are there some of those close calls that you could share with us?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you one little war story. We operated really out of Port Moresby, 7 miles, over the Owen Stanley Range, and the Japanese had a base called Lei. And this mission was to destroy or beat up Lei a little. I dropped my bombs, and we did hit the airfield for a change, and my bombardier said, I just saw 4 zeros take off while the bombs were going down. And in, I think, about 15 minutes, those zeros were doing circles around me. And I had that old B-17 full bore, and the Japanese zeros were shooting 20-millimeter cannons at us. And the B-17, the best we had was 50 calibers and 130 caliber firing out the nose. Now, an airplane made to shoot you down and firing cannons at you, which is twice as big as your 50 caliber, and flying circles around you, who do you think is going to win? My waist gunner got a 20-millimeter cannon shell in his right on the top of his cranium, right here. Finally, those zeros left me. We got shot up pretty bad, and I thought I was going to lose my waist gunner. But we went into Horn Island, which is northern Australia, and we finally got some fuel and got back into Townsville, Australia, where my gunner could get some help, and they cut a big chunk in his head and took out part of his skull and put a silver plate in, and he was just fine. But when you see those big white balls coming straight at you, you just want to take that armor and turn it right down over your face. And you're alone now. You're only alone. One airplane. And the airplane was full of holes, of course. But that's the only... Oh, I brought back a dead tail gunner once. But you expect those things. And that's what you're paid for.
No, I hear that. And I know how many missions you had. I just have to wonder, when you're that age and you've developed these relationships with the guys on your crew, how that hits you when you see a guy missing a chunk of his head, or you see a guy that is not going to go home to his family. How did you deal with that at the time?
Well, actually, you just pressed on, that's all. It was a little bit more personal because I kept the same crew in the Pacific, and we were flying recce and bombs. We carried half fuel in one side of the airplane and bombs in the other side. And you do develop a certain camaraderie with your crew. But in England, all of my missions were lead crews, and I took and ran the pilot off of a good crew. So I never flew with the same crew because you're the air commander. So it wasn't too personal in the UK, but it was very personal in the Pacific because we lost a few crews.
Speaking of personal, how often did you hear from Betty Jo while you were out there flying all over the world?
I would get a letter, maybe a couple of letters a month, because right after Pearl Harbor, Betty Jo wrote me and said, the people are asking, where's the Navy? Where's our Navy? And I wrote back, the Navy is the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Well, I didn't find that out until after the war, and I got home, and Betty Jo said, all that was cut out of your letter, honey. Mail wasn't too frequently. But she was a beautiful letter writer, one of those people that could just write a beautiful, beautiful letter. And she was a beautiful, beautiful lady, of course. Great Air Force wife. Ah, there she is, the Betty Jo.
When he said that, he was referring to a large depiction of the plane that he finally got to paint his wife's name on. A plane you can see for yourself if you ever have the chance to visit the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio. What Robert Thacker did in that unique aircraft was something no one had ever done before. And we'll hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.